All right, thank you all for being patient. As you may or may not know, having registered for this webinar, you have decided to register because you're interested in the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program. My name is Sarah Causer. I'm out of the IIE Houston office, and I'm an outreach and recruitment specialist, and I get the pleasure to work on the recruitment plan for this program. Today I'm joined by a few different colleagues. The first one is Kaylee Atwater, who is in our DC office. Kaylee, would you like to do a quick introduction?
Sure. My name is Kaylee Atwater. I am a placement advisor in the DC office. As Sarah mentioned, I work on the placement portions of several programs here at IIE, of course, for the Scholar in Residence program, but then also for some other undergraduate programming.
Thanks, Kaylee. And we're also joined by David Levin from the Department of State. David, would you like to say hello?
Sure. This is David Levin. I'm a senior program manager in the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs at State, and one of the programs that I get to oversee is Fulbright Scholar in Residence.
Wonderful. Thank you. And then also on the line, and she might make an appearance, is Susan Mundell, who is also at IIE. Just in case you hear her voice later on, I don't want you to be shocked. But she is also on the line and happy to answer any questions you might have. So kicking it off, before we get into kind of the overview of the Fulbright program, I just wanted to give a little bit more information about the system we are using. So this program is currently recording this webinar, and so after the presentation ends, we will convert it and put this webinar online, so it will be archived for you to listen to at a further date. The PowerPoint will also be there for you to access, and all the hyperlinks throughout this presentation will be able to be utilized. Also, at the end of this presentation, moving forward, we will get to a Q&A portion, so if you have any questions, please feel free to submit them throughout. I will start off the presentation with a general overview of Fulbright as well as the Scholar in Residence program. Kaylee will then take it over talking about the application components, tools, and resources, and throughout we'll actually be having David add his own insight into the program kind of throughout the duration of this presentation. All right, so let's get started. So the Fulbright Scholar program was established, or the Fulbright program in general, was established in 1946, so we're currently in the 73rd year of this program. The program was established really as a public diplomacy program, and its goal was to really strengthen the relationship between the people of the United States and the rest of the world. So this program sends academics and professionals overseas, as well as brings scholars and professionals from abroad to the United States, which is what you'll hear more about with this program and a way to really internationalize your campus. On this screen, you can see two photos that, in my opinion, really show the breadth of the program. On the left, you see this black and white image. It's one of our first scholars to Burma when we did open relations with that country and one of the first kind of scholar grants to that country. Whereas on the right, you'll see a lovely scholar in the snow dog sledding, and she was part of our newer Fulbright Arctic Initiative, which is currently in its second year, that brings scholars together to conduct joint research projects, collaborative research projects, as well as their own individual research projects, but primarily focusing on Arctic issues and things of that nature. I'd be remiss not to talk about the sponsor. So the Fulbright Scholar Program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. And since its initiation, it's been administered by the Institute of International Education. So that's why you have Kaylee, myself, and David on this line to really kind of show you the extent of the overview and administration of this program. So the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program is an institutionally driven program. It's a wonderful opportunity for you at your institution to bring scholars and faculty members from overseas to your campus. Ideally, these campuses might not have strong international presence. They might not have that ability to bring Fulbright scholars on an annual basis. So this is a wonderful opportunity for you to really partner with us, and we try and help you as much as possible to bring these scholars and give you these opportunities to have this international voice on your campus. It also helps with the internationalization of your campus and developing exchange courses moving forward. And these scholars primarily teach at the full kind of undergraduate course load. We have seen some graduate courses, but that's few and far removed. Primarily, these scholars are teaching kind of a liberal arts curriculum, social sciences, humanities on your campus. These scholars are not on your campus to teach languages. We actually have another program for that, which I'd be happy to answer any questions about later on. That's through the Fulbright Language Teaching Assistantship. But as we said, you know, this is really for these scholars to kind of come into the classroom, take on a full undergraduate course load for either a semester or a full academic year. Just for your knowledge, throughout the year, Fulbright brings around 900 visiting scholars to campus, and about 30 to 40 of these scholars actually end up being these scholar-in-residence. So we have a strong presence across the United States, and we do list all of these institutions online, and we're happy to connect you with them if you do have any other questions. So kind of moving on, any other information you have, we'll kind of dive into those application components. But effectively, one of the main changes this year going into it is the deadline is actually now a little bit later. It's going to be November 1st. It gives you two more weeks in your fall schedule to really compile those applications and submit them. And one of the most unique things I know Kaylee will discuss is with these SIR applications, you actually can submit a proposal a month ahead of time for us to review and provide feedback on. Our email is on the screen, so if you have any questions that don't get answered today, please feel free to reach out. David, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I think that's a good beginning, and I think the audience will gain a sense of really how exciting this program is and how flexible it is and how the objective of this program, which is unique in some respects among Fulbrights, it's really designed to serve the host institution.
Exactly. And one of the things I would love to point out on this slide, this photo is actually one of our Ghanaian scholars who was actually a dance instructor. And so he went to Ohio Northern to teach dance, and he was actually really sought after by other institutions. And so you can see he's with one of his dance classes. So you really, as David said, the program's flexible. It's kind of a you make it what you want program, like build your own Fulbright on your campus. So we do hope this is of interest to you all. So jumping off of that, I actually do want to pass the microphone to David to really talk about the program benefits and how this program can allow you to increase mutual understanding and globalization.
Yeah, thanks very much. So the concept of this program, it really is internationalization. Bringing a Fulbright scholar to your campus for a semester or a year, we sort of look at what that scholar does, sort of three legs of the stool. One is, obviously, as Sarah's talked about, they're teaching courses, primarily at the undergraduate level. You determine what that might be. Lots of people are in humanities and social sciences, but in fact, any field is open as long as you can demonstrate that bringing that scholar to campus provides a comparative or international perspective that wouldn't be available otherwise. Beyond that, beyond the courses that they're teaching, the classes that they're teaching, we want to look at ways that that scholar can be engaged with students and faculty and administrators across campus in a whole variety of ways so that they really get a sense of campus life. They do a whole variety of things that help them become connected to students and faculty beyond the classes they're teaching. And then the third leg of the stool is having them engage with your community outside of campus, your local community, and what kinds of things could they do that help them develop an international perspective and learn more about America, at the same time helping your local community get a better connection with them. So it really is all about internationalization, your curriculum, your campus, your community. And as I said, this program really is designed to meet your needs. The scholars there to help you internationalize, achieve what you're trying to do with this scholar, providing their expertise, their experience, the cultural perspective. Our sense is when we do, as Sarah said, we do 35 or 40 of these a year, and they really make a huge difference on lots and lots of campuses.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, David. So moving kind of along that vein about the campuses we try to impact with this type of program, you can see on the screen is a small kind of scope of who we are trying to interact with. As I said earlier, we are trying to engage with institutions that may not have access to these resources. Those oftentimes include our minority-serving institutions, our small liberal arts, our community colleges, and our rural colleges and universities. So predominantly our full bread and butter is what is listed on this screen. However, if your institution really exists outside of this scope and type of institutions, that's not to say you can't apply. You're more than welcome to, but what we would actually suggest is that you partner with another local institution and share a scholar. So in doing that, we've seen it in a couple of different ways. If you're very close to a campus, you could kind of share them throughout the semester and full academic year, whereas Monday, Wednesday, Friday on one, Tuesday, Thursday on another, or it could be if you apply for a full academic year, one semester, one college will utilize the scholar, and the second semester, the other one will. So as I said earlier, it's kind of a design-your-own type of program. The choice is really up to you. We are always looking for creative proposals. So if this is something that kind of jumps out at you, we're more than happy to kind of share our insight of working with institutions that have done this before. Most notably, I am aware of kind of instances in Oklahoma with Tulsa. They partnered with a local community college to work on these, but we've seen it kind of across the United States with these partnerships. And with that, I'm actually going to pass the mic for a little bit over to Kaylee to talk about the application component.
Yes, thank you so much, Sarah. And for anyone who joined a little bit late, just I'm seeing some questions come into the chat box, so just to clarify, this webinar and the Scholar in Residence program is geared towards U.S. institutions who would like to apply to host a visiting scholar in the U.S. So I hope that that helps to answer any questions. But yeah, so happy to jump ahead with talking about the application itself. But first, a quick note on webinars. So this one is more of an overview. We'll just be kind of touching upon the different components of the application and the program as a whole. And then in June, we'll actually be having a webinar and providing a more in-depth walkthrough of the application. And then in the fall, we'll also be having some last call webinars, they're called. And those are kind of like office hours where you can send in questions beforehand or show up to the webinars and just engage directly with myself and Sarah and our colleagues to ask any last-minute questions. But yeah, so back to the application. Anyone listening in who's familiar with the application or may have gone through the process in the past, you'll see that we have a brand new application system this year, and it's called Slate. So it's great. It's easy to use. You'll see that the format has changed very slightly from last year and from any previous years, but the content itself has really remained the same. So you'll see upon starting an application that there are some shorter application sections in which you enter text or use drop-downs, followed by a section that asks you to upload a number of documents. So one tip that we like to give is that it's always just so helpful for institutions to get into the application early. So just go in there and start one and kind of click through and see what's actually required, what you might need to pull together as you go through this process. It just really helps to actually see it on the computer in front of you, I know. I'd also encourage you to take a look at our application guidelines, which I think Sarah had said she'd link to in the PDF afterwards, and you can also find it on our website. And that just really shows you the components in great detail of everything with this application. So for these first sections that I was mentioning with those drop-downs and text boxes, you'll see on the screen the individual components. So it's more basic sections. You'll mostly be writing in names, contact information, things like that. But I do want to highlight a few pieces. So you'll see that there are two contacts listed here. One is the administrative official. So that's anyone who can sign off on the affiliation information. And then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these contacts, we defer to your institution as far as to how it's made up to determine who the appropriate individual is. So we're not going to say, okay, this person must be the dean of this school, because sometimes it might need to be a professor, actually, or vice versa. So definitely reach out to us if you have any questions. And then for program dates, we do work pretty far in advance, so you should actually be listing dates for the 2020 to 2021 academic year, which is crazy. So this application cycle that has just opened is actually for those years. And then we'll also be discussing financial support and named versus recruited scholars in a moment, but you'll actually just list the more basic information in this first section here. And then lastly, there's a proposal summary that gives our viewers a snapshot of what your program entails. So it's really helpful if you really use this section to highlight all of your major proposal pieces. Okay, and the next slide, Sarah. Okay, and I'm sorry if you can hear the sirens outside, but I'll continue. Okay, so now we are getting into the next section called the narrative. So this is really the main essence of the application, and it's divided into two parts. So we have the first part here. This is the institutional profile, and that is 4 to 5 pages long, or 7 to 8 if you're submitting for one of the joint proposals that Sarah had mentioned, since you're doubling the institution. And then just keep in mind that reviewers may or may not know your institution. So this section is really key to giving them a better idea of your institution and who you are. So things that you'll include in this institutional profile include institution information, as listed on the screen here. So it's often helpful to just really simply break the pages down by section. So in this 4 to 5 pages or 7 to 8 pages, you'd slot in a few paragraphs, for example, under a mission heading or under the academic offerings heading, and then on down the line. And that just really helps has helped past applicants to just really get a feel for what we're looking for and how to divide it up. And even if they're dividing, writing the proposal among themselves, it just helps to keep everyone all organized. And we will be having some, I think we'll be having some previous hosts and also previous scholars online in future webinars. So that will be a really great thing to log in to hear what they have to say. Okay. So then in this main section here, we just want to see how your institution is set up, what you have in place, what you don't have in place on campus that an FIR could help with. And then this section is also where you indicate your institution's short and long-term goals, as you can see at the bottom of the slide there. So their goals and objectives. So really, what are you hoping to gain through internationalizing your campus, and how specifically would hosting a scholar in residence assist and fit into those goals? So David, I just wanted to throw it over to you to see if you have anything to add for this first part of the narrative proposal, anything that you've seen that's worked well in the past.
No, I think that was good. I would say that you, in describing your institution, you want to talk about what would the value be to you for bringing a scholar in residence to campus. How does this fit into your short and long-term goals in terms of campus internationalization? So, you know, think through this creatively. And often it seems that the best proposals are the proposals that are done in the sense of by a committee. Because we're talking about the impact that the scholar could have across campus beyond teaching, you know, beyond the specific coursework in a given department, let's say, or a couple departments, but what else could they be doing across campus? Often the best way to think through what might that look like is to put together a small group of people on campus who can think through this from a number of perspectives. And it seems like with this program, that has proven to be, I think, the best success, because you, in a sense, are designing a blueprint that we'll talk about you know, you're a scholar, what would they do? You think through this in advance so that you're really prepared for that scholar. So it's really a win-win situation for you and for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great, thank you. And I know that things that we've talked about in the past, too, is how institutions would put in information about their current study abroad programming or their current international programming just to see where things stand and where they might have any gaps that a scholar in residence could fill in. So just things like that. And again, all of this is in the application guidelines, so it really does go through everything in detail. But thank you so much, David. Okay. Sarah, could we go to the next slide? Thank you. Okay, so then the second part of the narrative proposal is where you show what the FIR program is trying to accomplish for you, whereas before you were just giving us kind of an overview of the institution and where things stand. So this one is 8 to 9 pages, or it could be 12 to 13 if you're submitting a joint proposal. And then within the oversight section here, you're addressing who on campus will be responsible and for what during the entirety of the visit. So you've already identified two contacts in that first part of the application I mentioned, that administrative official and that principal contact for academic arrangements. So this is where you could actually go further into it, whereas before you were just kind of putting in contact information. Here you can actually give a nice background of those individuals and what they'll be doing for the visiting scholar on campus. So kind of along the lines of what David was saying about the application as a whole, we've seen this oversight section take various forms. So there could be a few faculty or staff listed here, or there could be a whole Fulbright steering committee that engages staff from different college departments or backgrounds. But again, this is really just all dependent on the specific college or university. We just want to see what thought has been put into the potential scholars program on campus and that they and you as the institution are going to be set up for success during the program. Then we have the academic program of the scholar. So here you would actually talk about what qualifications or background a scholar should have to meet the proposal's needs, and then even jump into the need for the courses themselves. We often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus, and we see about an average of 2 per semester. But again, give or take, it all depends on the type of proposal you're submitting. And then sometimes the scholar might be teaching an already designed course on campus and just bringing a more international perspective into that existing curriculum. But other times they might be creating an entirely new course or syllabus. So just highlighting this type of information is really important for us and for the reviewers to understand the amount of preparation that might need to go into completing those activities. So be sure, as we've all been saying, sounding like a broken record, just discuss how the scholar in residence will interact all across campus, even all across the community. So this should just really show that you've thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. We have professional enrichment. So we said that this is an institutionally driven application, but we do want to see that there's potential for the scholar's individual growth. So you could include them in faculty meetings, orientations for new faculty, attending academic conferences, things like that. So sustainability, so focusing on how you would sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. And David, would you want to talk for a moment about some successful options that we've seen in the past in terms of sustainability after a scholar actually leaves campus?
Sure. So we've seen things from the scholar teaching an online class after they returned home, so they remain in contact with your institution. We've certainly seen lots of cases where the two schools have developed study abroad programs or faculty exchanges. We've talked about ways where a scholar, for example, who was in business, worked with the local community, ended up developing a sort of a dual chamber of commerce of a sort between their host state and their home country. So think creatively about how would you want to stay engaged with this scholar after they returned home, and how could you maintain a connection with them and with their institution.
Mm-hmm. All right, perfect. Thank you. Okay. Then the last note here is financial support. Oh, can you go back there? Thanks. So for the financial support, in one of the previous sections, you would have just put in the actual dollar amounts in there. But then in this section in the narrative, you can actually expand on the cost share and what you're able to provide. Just a note on this is that cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to think creatively of ways that they can provide this, but it's not required. It won't make or break an application. You won't be disqualified if you can't provide cost share. We see this looking like a salary supplement, or it could be in-kind support, so like a meal plan or providing or defraying the cost of housing, providing transportation or auditing classes. So this is where you'd actually be providing estimates of what that would equate to and what it's valued at, and then just provide a little bit more information if it's available. And again, David, if you want to expand on any of the financial support that we've seen in the past.
No, I think those were good examples, Kaylee, that schools can think about. We realize that I mean, sort of the gold standard, if it's doable for you, is to actually mm-hmm. provide some kind of, actual dollars that are seen as a salary supplement. Some schools can do that, some can't. If you said to me, what's the sort of the range we've seen, and it's clearly anything between $0 and $50,000 as a mm-hmm. salary supplement. So it really depends on your institution and your financial capability. And as Kaylee said, some schools can do that, some can't. We say to you, if you can't do the actual cash arrangement, salary supplement, other things that you could do, as Kaylee suggested, whether it's a meal plan, whether it's perhaps providing some funding to enable your scholar in residence to join your local faculty attending a professional association conference or a meeting. Maybe it's something like if your scholar has dependents, maybe it's enabling them to take ESL classes. You may surprise yourself in fact in terms of the kinds of things that you might find available on campus or within the community that we would consider, you know, a cost share, whether it's cash or whether it's in kind.
All right, perfect. Okay, and then the next slide, please. And actually, that one of the pieces that David had mentioned made me want to say, so Sarah was saying earlier that a lot of the scholars that we see are arts and humanities and social sciences, but when he was talking about the one of the chambers, how they did kind of a dual chamber, so we really do see all fields going through here. So just because you're not necessarily in one of those social sciences or humanities field doesn't mean that this program might not be a good fit for you. So again, feel free to reach out with any questions if you have them. Okay, getting into the scholar itself. So after the narrative portion, so those two main uploaded documents that you'll be putting into the application, we then want to hear more about the scholar that you wish to bring. So the Scholar in Residence program allows for two different tracks. You can either name a scholar or you can ask for recruitment of a scholar. For naming, you can name a scholar in your proposal that maybe a faculty member has worked with in the past, or that your institution has connections with their institution or something along those lines. So if you do name a scholar, please outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular grant, because this is institutionally driven. We want to make sure that you are set up for success with meeting your proposal's needs. So we ask that you submit a CV and two letters of recommendation for a named scholar. One should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they're coming to your campus to primarily undertake teaching. And then you'll also want to ensure that they have the required English skills to successfully teach that topic on campus. If you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections, that's no problem at all. You can request the recruitment of a scholar. So you'll be able to choose two different countries within one world region, and those world regions are listed on our website. If you don't see a country that you're interested in, reach out to us, let us know, and we can discuss. And then in the proposal, though, you'll include information about the type of scholar that you would like for us to recruit. So we actually use these details that you include in the application to reach out to our colleagues abroad to see if they'd be able to recruit a scholar within that discipline or specialization that you're requesting. So we ask that you outline the credentials of the scholar, if there's a certain amount of teaching experience that they need in order to teach on your campus, or any degree requirements, as if anything really helps us to narrow down recruitment efforts. And we do often get questions about if your chances are better to either name or request recruitment of a scholar. So David, would you mind, from your perspective, from Department of State perspective, of the named versus recruit?
Sure. To us, it can work either way. There's no preference. It really depends on your situation as an institution. I would say that in a given year, probably 3/4 of the requests are for named scholars, and that's fine. But we certainly get a number of requests where recruitment is requested, and that's fine too. In the case where you're asking for recruitment, we ask you to specify typically 2 countries within 1 region. We do that specifically for a reason. If in fact scholars from country X, if country X is not able to recruit successfully for you, then we would have another country that you would have listed as a possibility as well. And we work with both countries simultaneously. That ensures that if one doesn't come through, the other one may. But we talk about it in terms of 2 scholars or 2 countries from the same region. And the point I would make there is please talk about both countries in your proposal so that it doesn't look like one is necessarily favored over the other. It makes it difficult for us to recruit if proposals talk about country A being a preference versus country B. So I guess I would just only do that if, in fact, that's your desire, but you're better off if you talk about both countries as possibilities for you. And as I said, it doesn't make a difference to us. We certainly have Fulbright commissions in U.S. embassies around the world that are very willing to recruit for this program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we do often get questions from institutions as they're going through this application process, because it's kind of hard to walk the line between like how you write about a specific scholar in your proposal versus how you kind of keep it general and keep it open so that it's more what your institution needs as opposed to about a specific scholar coming to your campus. So once again, happy to answer questions if they might arise as you're going through this process. But yeah, so in the interest of time, let's move ahead to the supplemental materials, right? So I've kind of broken apart in this PowerPoint here the uploaded section. So there really is just one section where you're uploading just a number of materials. So this is just another one of those uploaded materials that you'll be putting directly into the application. So the letters of support section here, these would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. So at a minimum, you should have a letter of support from the administrative official. There is no maximum number of letters of support, so you can seek out letters from different departments across your institutions, even neighboring institutions, if you're arranging like community outreach or activities or anything like that. If you do upload a letter of support, this doesn't mean that you're setting it in stone. It's just more so showcasing the excitement of the larger community and the willingness to host the scholar in residence on campus. And then kind of conversely, this can also grow once the scholar arrives, so you're not bound to just these letters of support. You could also, of course, have other ways of engaging with the scholar in the larger campus. And then we also have the sample syllabi or course outline. So we'd like to see what the proposed courses entail, get a sense for what they're about. If you're naming a specific scholar, you might have insight into what they'll be able to teach more specifically and craft it in a way that will enhance their cultural perspective. But again, we understand that things may change. So these syllabi or these outlines really are just samples, and they're not the be-all and end-all of the course syllabi. Okay. And then next up, we have the review criteria. So once you move forward with your application, so you click submit, and it's very exciting, you might be curious as to what the external review committee is looking for during review. Just really make sure that all pieces are working together to give them a picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting the scholar in residence. So just really every single component, just think of how it can strengthen why should you be hosting a scholar in residence. So saying the short-term and long-term goals and how, so not just stating those goals, but also saying how hosting a scholar in residence would contribute to meeting these goals. We already discussed most of these when we were kind of running through the application components, but just to hone in on a few pieces here, you'll want to think through if the proposal is feasible within the time period. So that is definitely something that reviewers look at. They say, oh, wow, they're proposing this number of courses and only this amount of time. It might be difficult for them to successfully complete what is being proposed. You'll also kind of expanding as much as possible on the community outreach and engagement aspect, creating that network across the institution. That's something that we keep saying in this is just really showing how it's community-wide, community-driven. And then take the time to think through that sustainability element. So are other professors sitting in and learning about what the scholar is teaching and help sustain it? Okay. And I think we're moving on to the review process and timeline, so I think we'll be shifting back to Sarah.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kaylee and David, for that thorough overview of the program. As Kaylee said earlier, we will be having other webinars, and I have a slide coming up with those dates. But with those webinars, we will have alumni voices from the various types of institutions. So that might be a good kind of next step for you if you're coming from a community college and you want more insight from a successful community college host. We highly encourage you to register for those types of webinars. So between now and October, we will be conducting those webinars. As I said earlier, the new deadline is November 1st. It is no longer October 15th, so make sure to put November 1st on your calendars. As Kaylee and I have both mentioned, that draft proposal where we can review and offer critical feedback on your application will still be October 1st, so it gives us a little bit longer to kind of work with you to kind of comb through your application and really submit the best application for you and your institution. So that is a great added benefit that you don't always see, so I highly, highly, highly encourage you to take advantage of that draft proposal deadline. So once we receive and close the application on November 1st, our staff will conduct a technical review for completeness of your application, just ensuring that you have uploaded all those materials through the new online system, nothing was skipped. If it has been skipped, we will reach out to you and work with you to ensure we get that. We're not looking at any point in this process to cut applications down. So we will work with you if something gets submitted blank, goes over any page limits, things like that. In December, we will have our external review committee. They'll meet at that point and make their selections of institutions that they would like to move forward. At that point, you will be notified of the outcome sometime in January. While that is occurring, ECA, Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board will review the recommended proposals of that committee moved forward in December, and IIE will work with them to confirm the institutional funding. So anywhere from January to April, we will be confirming scholars, whether or not you requested a certain scholar, and if you requested recruitment, we will be working with the embassies as well as the Fulbright commissions overseas to find and locate scholars that meet those credentials that you put forth in your application. And then anywhere from about July, it's a little early, through early fall, the scholars will start to arrive on your campus if you were successful. And that being said, if you're applying just for a semester being the spring, then they'll arrive in summer, January at that point. But that's kind of our overview timeline for what it looks like. As Kaylee said, you know, you are really prepping early for these scholars, but it does help you because you will have to promote these courses in catalogs to get students to apply and register for these courses. So we try and be kind of ahead of the game so it works with your institution and the timelines that you guys are also facing. All right. Kaylee mentioned we do have resources. So this PowerPoint will go live once the recording is complete, and I'll also message it to all attendees of this webinar. So at any given time, if you want to review it again, please feel free, but we'll also have those other webinars forthcoming. I'm happy to answer any phone calls that you guys might have. I'll be happy to schedule kind of one-on-one sessions to really listen to you and kind of get your thoughts if this is a program that your institution wishes to apply for, which I think every institution should, in my personal opinion. But on the website right now, you can actually access that online application that's called Slate that Kaylee was talking about, as well as the current application guidelines for this cycle. The webinars are also listed, so feel free to register for all of them if you so chose. And just keep in mind, again, those draft proposals are due no later than October 1st. If you have any questions about that, please reach out. And at any given point, we're just happy to really work with you kind of to finalize this. One quick plug, if you are interested in addition to applying for the Scholar in Residence program, if you also are interested in a Fulbright opportunity for you overseas, we have this lovely tab at the bottom called My Fulbright, and that's for you to register your interest in the program, perhaps the region or discipline that you focus on. So, again, this session is really streamlining geared towards institutions applying, but we're happy to work with you if you also have desires to apply for the program for yourself. As Kaylee and I said, we have upcoming webinars. So the dates and the times are listed. The majority of the times are 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern time, except for our rural college and universities webinar. Obviously, we wanted to put it at a time that was a little better for that region, the Rocky Mountain region. So we did move that one a bit later. All of these webinars will be recorded. So again, if you can't make one of these sessions, still register because, again, you'll get the first notification that the webinar has been archived and is online. So I highly encourage you to register. Again, all of this will be clickable for you to sign up from this PowerPoint when it goes online. And then the last thing we really just want to highlight is another program that is quite similar to the Scholar in Residence program, but a little shorter and a little less, in some cases, cost prohibitive, time prohibitive. But I encourage all institutions to apply for SIR as well as the Outreach Lecturing Fund. So we said there's about 900 visiting scholars in the United States, and that's inclusive of these SIR scholars. At any given point, your institution can apply to bring one of these 900 visiting scholars to your campus for a short-term lectureship. That's anywhere from 2 to 6 days for these scholars to come to your campus to talk about their discipline, their experience on Fulbright, as well as cultural topics that might relate to their home country. As you saw earlier, far back in this presentation, we had that Ghanaian dance scholar. He actually went on a few of these OLS. He was requested by many institutions. And one of my favorite stories and videos that came out of it was him teaching a bunch of K through fourth graders local traditional dances. And the videos were priceless, and I'm very excited for the true extent that these visiting scholars get to give back and to local communities, and it's also professional development for them. There is no true deadline. It's a rolling deadline. We just ask you to apply a month ahead. But if anyone has any questions, I also oversee this program along with David Levin. But feel free to email olaf@iie.org, and I'd be happy to work with you. But again, they're really looking for the same types of institutions, minority-serving community colleges, small liberal arts. But again, if you exist outside of this world, partner. Partner with a local elementary school. Partner with a local community college. We would love to partner with you on these wonderful opportunities. And last but not least is our kind of summary page. You can see our social media at the bottom as well as our emails listed again. If you have any questions, I know David and myself and Kaylee, we're all so excited to work with you. We're happy to answer any questions you might have. And with that, we're going to start to segue into questions. The first of which I really wanted to highlight on here is we do have an institution, and David, I'm going to love your insight as well, is there is a professor, an institution applied to bring a visiting scholar from Kosovo through the Faculty Scholar Development Program. And this attendee wants to know what's the key difference between that Fulbright Scholar Development Program and Scholar in Residence. And to my knowledge, one is primarily to do research, while the Scholar in Residence is primarily to teach. David, did you have any other insight from that program?
No, I think that's right. And I think the other difference is perhaps with the Scholar Development Program, sometimes the scholars that are coming on that program are perhaps earlier in their career, maybe a little more junior, maybe less experienced, maybe less fluent in English. They might not be, might be good academicians, but may not necessarily have the skills that really would be sufficient for you to have them come and teach, undergraduate courses and do lectures to the public in English and so forth. So both valuable experiences. I think they're a little bit different on the sort of the continuum of the experience and skills of the scholar who's participating.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I can also say on a more technical note, I know that those faculty development programs, they have like very specific timelines, very specific grant activities that those scholars need to be participating in while they're abroad. So one thing that if you've worked with Fulbright before is that you'll hear us always saying, like, it depends. It depends on the award. It depends on the program. So, of course, with the Scholar in Residence, it's the institution actually applying to host a Scholar in Residence, whereas other programs aren't like that. It's actually the scholar applying to go to a different country or a different region. So there's just a few different pieces. If you're ever not sure, just shoot us a message too, and then we can send you more information with links.
Perfect. Thank you both. We also got a question, and I know we discussed it a little bit, but David, what is kind of your thoughts with institutions applying to host more of a graduate-level courses as opposed to undergraduate?
So I think, we typically say that our preference is undergraduate instruction because quite often, obviously, community college would be purely undergraduate. Lots of minority-serving institutions don't have graduate-level programs. So I think because of the fact that we're giving preference to certain kinds of schools means that the majority of SIRs are doing undergraduate teaching. But it's not required. If you can make the case that a scholar coming to your campus could do both graduate and undergraduate, that's fine, as long as, again, you can make the case that says it's valuable for the scholar to do that and the engagement works well and there's broad representation across campus in terms of who the scholar is interacting with. So I think, we see a mix each year, even though, in general, the bulk of the SIRs are doing the undergraduate work.
Perfect. Thanks so much, David. One question came in from a faculty member at a Research One institution. They're curious if they can apply as a singular entity host, or would you suggest that they partner with the local HBCU in the area? Kind of what are their chances, either route they choose to go? I would say, and David, feel free to hop on this as well, I would definitely encourage you to partner with that local HBCU. Again, however you want to propose sharing, if it's one semester at one institution, the second at a the other. I think that tends to be a stronger, more compelling application. But we have seen some institutions apply on their own. To my knowledge, it's just a little more competitive for them because they didn't partner. David, would you like to also add your advice?
No, I would agree with that, Sarah. I think that's right. Typically, we would say, for example, to a Carnegie One school, you may have less of an issue with resources, and there may be more possibilities for you to bring a scholar in residence or some kind of other scholar to your campus on your own, as opposed to many of the targeted schools that we're reaching out to don't have the same level of resources that you might have and are therefore a little more reliant on scholar residence as a way of bringing someone to campus. So, you know, every year we certainly do have some Carnegie One schools or other classification schools, you know, sort of the schools that are more advantaged applying and getting SIRs. I think by and large, you're enhancing your chances if you in fact do a joint proposal with one of the targeted type of schools.
And I'd say from an application standpoint, those would applying as a singular host versus joint, those would look very different, even as to what you're including from your own section. So you might choose to highlight different things if you're choosing to apply as a singular host. You'd definitely want to have a good number of letters of support from the larger community, just showing that it's engaged with more than just that host institution, whereas a joint proposal kind of naturally has multiple points of contact on different campuses and in different parts of the community. So there's just, again, how we've said that all of those different application components really need to kind of serve the whole and strengthen the whole. So I think that it would look like a very different kind of application if you do a singular versus joint.
Wonderful. Thank you both. We have one kind of logistical question about visas and obtaining them. Is this something that Fulbright does, or do institutions need to do this? Kaylee, would you like to add your insight?
Possibly, yeah. So, yes, IIE issues visas. We also administer other parts of the program for the scholars and residents that are chosen to come to your campus. So Sarah had kind of walked through the timeline during application and post-application. And during that post-application part, if you're selected to host a scholar in residence, you hear from us. So we are kind of working at the same time with the scholar to go through a number of processes, make sure that they have the visas all set and ready to go. But then at the same time, we're also working with you to make sure that we've collected all the information that we need from you, we've shared it between you and the scholar, all things like that. So, yeah, to answer your question, IIE does help to obtain the visas for those scholars.
Hi, this is Susan Mundell. I'm just going to jump in here really quickly. I'm also at IIE. And just a point of clarification, IIE does not, we do not issue the visas, and we're not able to provide any visa guidance, but we do provide the DS 2019, which is it's the supporting documentation that will assist the scholar in applying for the visa in their home country. But we do have our U.S. embassies and our Fulbright commissions abroad that will provide the guidance to aid them in obtaining that visa. But we do provide the documentation in support of their visa. So that's not something that the host institution needs to worry about.
I knew we would need your expertise on that, Susan. Thank you for providing that as well, and thank you as well, Kaylee. We have a clarification question about that faculty development program. If a scholar was to apply or to be kind of recruited through that scholar in residence program, would they also be able to apply for the development program? I'm assuming that's in like a subsequent year. David, do you have thoughts about the two different programs?
Yeah, I'm not quite clear what the caller is talking about. In terms of scholar residence, because this is institutionally driven, it's really up to you as an institution to determine who you would like to take on that assignment, whether it's someone that you specifically know and are making a name request, or whether you are asking us to recruit for you. On occasion, we'll get a question that says, could a scholar make application on their own and be available for placement, in a sense? And we don't work that way with SIR because of the fact that the likelihood that a scholar is simply available and waiting for you as an institution, based on the differences between institutions in terms of where are you located and what kind of scholar are you looking for and from what country and in what field, the likelihood that we have a sort of a roster of candidates available to choose from doesn't really work. We want to do this in a tailored way so that we're reaching out and either confirming your name request or recruiting for you to take on an assignment. The other point that I think would make is if you tell me that here's a scholar whose home institution says, yes, go ahead and put your name on a roster and you're available almost at any time to take up an assignment and leave for a year, that doesn't speak volumes in terms of the sort of the value that your home institution will put on you, because a key objective of this program is the scholar comes on the scholar in residence program, goes back home, and like any other Fulbright grant, then shares that Fulbright experience with their home institution, with their faculty, with their students, with others, and you know it's what you do returning on Fulbright, going home, is equally important to what you're doing while you're on your Fulbright. It's not simply sort of an arrangement where we sort of try to fill from a roster. So they're totally different programs. It clearly couldn't be the same year. If you're talking about a scholar doing one program 1 year and one program at a later date, that's doable. An individual can have more than one Fulbright, but you know we would look at that in terms of two distinct steps, totally different years, totally different operations, different guidelines, different purpose, and so on and so forth.
And I'd also say, so without as much familiarity about eligibility for the faculty development programs, I know that there might be sometimes they require a certain amount of time between Fulbright awards. So just a few things for that specific scholar to be looking at. They just really want to look at that specific program and its eligibility to see how they impact each other.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all. I think we got through those questions, and if any others kind of keep coming in as we're reaching the 2 o'clock mark, I'll make sure to respond to them after we conclude this webinar. But I just want to make one last pitch that our next webinar will be on April 9th. It will focus on community colleges applying to the Scholar in Residence program, and we actually have the pleasure of being joined by Rich Johnson from Harper College with his current SIR scholar from Costa Rica, Jairo, and they have been very involved with the program, and I know you'll gain excellent insight from them. So we hope you'll join us on April 9th. And with that, I just want to thank everyone again for coming, taking time out of your day to join this webinar, for Kaylee, Derek, and Susan for also participating. Thank you all for your advice, and we hope you will consider to applying for this program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.